I could go ahead and call a Senate.
I think, sure.
How you doing, bud?
These house got strained up. Go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's Thursday, March 1st, 2007, about 9:03. We're had a little logistical switches here, otherwise we would have been on time. Now, today on the agenda, we're going to hear from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation here in a few minutes. But with us today, we have the joint Senate and House Finance Committee meeting. We have from the Senate, we have Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, Senator Elton, and I'd like to go ahead and have Representative Bill Stoltz introduce the House members.
Senator Dyson.
Excuse me, Senator Dyson is just coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was pausing for just a second, hoping I'd have more than one other person. Vice Chair Stoltz and Representative Thomas from the Finance Committee. Thank you.
Apparently, there's another meeting that the other finance folks are at dealing with issues of gas and budgets. But with us today, I'd like to go ahead and have come forward Mr. Carl Brady, the chair of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and also ask Mr. Mike Burns to come forward to president of the corporation. And we're going to go over today the value of the permanent fund and some of the changes. We'd also like to hear about upcoming dividend projections. So we'll be talking in the tens of billions and probably the rates of return, what we could expect as far as gains, which would be in the billions. And we can talk a little bit about our dividends, which will be a little over 1,000. And then we'll boil it right on down to 50 cents. And the chairman would like to know where his 50 cents is.
God, it's about as good as predicting what happened on Tuesday.
Okay. Go ahead and start your presentation.
Market.
And please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Carl Brady. I am the chairman of the board of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. My colleagues have elected me for the fourth consecutive year as the chairman of the board. I don't think it's because I'm that good. I think I am impatient with taking long meetings. So I'm rewarded in that regard. With us today, though, is the vice chair, Steve Frank. Steve Frank, many of you know, was a member of this committee in the Senate. And also Bill Hudson, he is with us. He was a member of the House Finance Committee. I'm using my cue cards here. A newly appointed member is Bill Moran from Ketchikan, president of First Bancorp, and is the revenue commissioner here?
Yes, sir.
Pat Galvin, the newly appointed commissioner of revenue by Governor Palin. And we were looking forward to also another board member just recently appointed as the Commissioner of Commerce to the Permanent Fund Board is Emil Noddy, whom I'm sure all of you know and recognize. And he was a member of the Permanent Fund Board in the early 80s, I think mid-80s, 85, 86. Is Eric Wolfert here? We have a former trustee that spent 12 years on this board by the name of Eric Wolfert that we're going to recognize today as thank you for 12 years. We have, this is the 30th anniversary since the initial $734,000 deposit was made. And on November of 1976 to create the fund's capital. That's when the vote took place. Following this meeting, we're going to have somewhere around here some cake to celebrate all this, 30 years. Without being facetious, I would like and love to answer your questions, Mr. Chairman, about the permanent funds future and near future rates, returns, and results, and what it does, and how it does, and how and what it does contribute. The problem I have with that is that on this fiscal year, we don't know what our contribution, assuming you appropriate it, it will be to take this very complicated formula that we have, most of us don't understand very well how to compute, and turn it into a dividend. That's why I keep, every chance I get, I talk about percent of market value, because it would be a very simple way to calculate the dividends. And it's hard to get that thing addressed. But I'll tell you a story. Not long ago, a fellow from a businessman in Nome called me and said, what is the dividend going to be? Because I sell four-wheelers and outboard motors and boats in the summer, and I sell snow machines in the winter. I got to figure out my inventory coming up based on how much money is going to be dumped into Nome on this dividend deal. And it was about May. I said, I wish I could tell you, sir. I wish I could, but I can't. It's not predictable under the current formula. Percent of market value would be a more predictable approach. I mean, not would be, it is. I'm not, since I was fortunate enough to give an opportunity to have the microphone, I'm not going to spend all your time lobbying for something I feel strongly about. So, but having said that, Tuesday was Tuesday, and it's gone, and tomorrow is tomorrow, and the markets are healthy. There's an enormous amount of cash. Maybe we're awash in cash in the world, and we'll see what's going to happen with us. In the meantime, we spend a great deal of energy and effort on our part in doing what I think is the smartest thing we can do, and that's create asset allocation in the sense of diversification. We are broadly diversified, despite what you may read or hear. The answer is to diversify, and we are doing that. And we're balancing this thing. And with inflation proofing, my sense is that we're going to continue meeting our targets, which are a nominal rate of return and adjusted for inflation proofing, and we'll continue to do that. We, this body, I've been around here since, except for when Tony Knowles fired me, I've been around since 1990 in this place. So I feel strongly that you've got a good managed fund. I think the current staff and with the leadership of Mr. Burns, we're all fortunate to have what we've got. So, unfortunately, I spent more time than was scheduled, but I hope I gave you some enlightenment. And with that, I'd like now to turn it over to Executive Director, not President, Executive Director, Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I am, you know, for the record, Mike Burns, and Executive Director of the Permanent Fund. We're going to have Mr. O'Leary join me here in a moment. I had originally planned to start my remarks with the Permanent Fund's performance since we last presented to you in February. On Monday, my plan was that by today I would be telling you that we had crested the $38 billion threshold. I think it's said or often said that God loves it when you make a plan. But rather than speaking specifically to our performance for the past 8 months, it first may be useful to look at what happened Tuesday just for a moment. And I would think Mr. O'Leary might have some comments just from a broader perspective of his time with the markets. A sharp decline in the Chinese stock market Tuesday was followed by a sell-off in the markets around the world. This caused a loss of $630 million in the fund's investment portfolio, and we closed Tuesday with a market value of $37.3 billion. While this is certainly a significant loss from a dollar perspective, I don't think it's not the largest percentage drop that the fund has seen in a single day. Markets have been strongly trending upward over the last few months, and while this correction was dramatic, it wasn't wholly unexpected. The magnitude and swiftness was what was unexpected. At the end of the day, our investments still, year to date, are very close to returning 11% for the fiscal year we're in right now, and that's well ahead of our long-term goal. A correction like this is to be expected when you invest in public or private markets. I think it's important to continue to always remember the permanent fund is a long-term investor, and this event has no effect on our asset allocation. The board and the staff will hold to our policy of making asset allocations based on the long-term projections we'll talk about this morning from Callan and Mr. O'Leary. We'll talk about those. I would like to cover a little bit of our performance for last fiscal year and the first part of this fiscal year. For fiscal year 2006, the fund returned 11%, well ahead of our benchmark of 10.5%. For the first time, the fund reached 31, 32, 33, 34, and $35 billion in value. We earned $3.1 billion on investments and received an additional $601 million in mineral royalties. We paid $689 million in dividends, ending the year with a balance of $32.9 billion, a gain of almost $3 billion over FY05. For the first 6 months of this year, this fiscal year, 2007, the fund returned 9.6% and closed on December 31st with an unaudited value of $36.4 billion. Statutory net income, and this is important because this is the number that goes into the dividend formula. Statutory net income as of December 31st was $1.9 billion. Statutory net income for the year FY02, which is the year that drops out of the five-year formula, was $257 million. So it's substantially going to change the dividend formula, or the dividend calculation. Performance since December was trending upward, and the permanent fund closed $40 million short of $38 billion on Monday. That was Monday. Most of the strong performance has been the result of gains in both the U.S. and non-U.S. stock markets, and the markets have held on to some of the gains made this calendar year. I now would like to ask Michael O'Leary of Callan Associates, the board's primary investment consultant, who goes over their capital market projections for you every February, to join us, and I'm very pleased to have him with us. So, Mr. O'Leary, if you come up.
Good morning.
Mr. O'Leary, maybe before you start with us, Senator Olson has arrived, and
two new finance members, Representative Jewell and Crawford, have joined us.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Mr. O'Leary.
For the record, my name is Michael O'Leary. I'm an executive vice president with Callan Associates, and I've had the pleasure of speaking many times before this group over the years. I'm going to quickly run through our five-year capital market projections. I'll give you the conclusion at the beginning. They are very little change from last year. You can follow along on the handouts. Clearly, in retrospect, calendar 2006 was a strong year. There was the economy did slow as the year progressed. We just all saw the real GDP numbers for the fourth quarter. But growth for the year was in excess of 3%. That is pretty close, in our view, to the long-term trend. We expect 07 to be a year below the long-term trend, so in the 2-plus range. How close it is to 2 and how close it is to 3 will be importantly influenced by the stabilization in housing, and we'll talk more about that. It will also depend importantly on how the consumer reacts. The positive effect from tax cuts on income have passed. There was some support for income, real disposable income, with the decline in energy prices that we saw in the second half of the year. Consumer confidence is quite high, but fragile. We are observing decent job growth, strong improvements in real wages, which had not been participating in the economic recovery, but now seem to be. And that's, in our mind, very important. The U.S. and China are the two major economies that have been growing the most rapidly. Our growth rate is nothing in comparison to China and many other emerging economies, but the scale of growth in China is something that can't be ignored. Clearly, oil prices will have an important influence on the outlook. The presumption that's in most forecasts is that they'll be somewhere in that broad range of 40 to 70, and they certainly seem to have stabilized of late near the $60 range. Inflation is very important to us when we form our capital market assumptions. We have a long-term, a five-year inflation projection of 2.75%. When we had that same projection a year ago, it was viewed as too high, too low by many, and now 2.75 is viewed as too high by many, where the consensus is probably much closer to 2. The Fed tightened significantly and stopped tightening at 5.25. Back in June, many thought that short-term rates would have been cut by now. Today, most expect that short-term rates will stay high through 07, or until the fourth quarter of 07. I'll pass quickly through several graphs that illustrate these points. This first one shows real GDP growth, annual rates of change, and the 07 estimate is from Global Insight. And you can see that their estimate is just a tad over 2. We think that that's pretty consistent with consensus expectations. The composition of that growth, of the growth that we've enjoyed, where has it come from? Consumption was really important. In 06, residential investment fell sharply and is still looking for a bottom. We have seen a pickup in business fixed investment. Federal government stimulus has decelerated, and state and local government budget pressure has eased. Importantly, exports are increasing and imports are still being affected by higher oil prices. This graph depicts residential fixed investment housing, and you can see the incredible strength going from 90 through 05, and then the downturn. This graph on page 5 depicts housing starts and the median existing single-family home price. You read the price on the right scale and the starts on the left scale, and the percentages on the right scale reflect year-over-year price change. So the types of homes, the median price is declining, and housing starts have obviously declined significantly. There was a news release just this week that sales of existing homes have increased sharply in January. It was the sharpest increase in 2 years, so that was very encouraging. And that came at the same time when there was news about another difficult period for new housing starts. It's important to remember that the existing home stock is much more important to the economy than new starts. Housing affordability, this is an index, an affordability index for existing single-family homes. The higher the number, the more affordable homes are. And it relates, it's affected, of course, not only by the price of homes, but by the level of interest rates. So what you can see has happened is, in recent years, the combination of rising home prices and increasing mortgage rates have made purchasing homes more difficult, less affordable. Last year when I was here, I made a big point of illustrating how important equity, people taking equity out of their homes was to supporting consumer spending. It's still important, but it is diminishing in importance, and the consumer's ability to gain equity is clearly diminished as housing prices have softened. Personal savings have fallen below zero. There are a lot of problems with this personal savings rate index. It excludes the value of homes. It excludes 401k types of contributions. But it does reflect general trends, and certainly the savings rate is very low. On the positive side, employment is still growing at a pretty hefty rate. And I made the point earlier about real wage growth. This is showing real average hourly earnings growth. And there's been a marked increase recently. This clearly was a major source of concern that here we were well into an economic recovery and real wages hadn't been increasing, and now they've really begun to increase significantly. Trying to put this all in perspective, the consumer, which is over two-thirds of the economy, has propelled growth over recent years, including 06, and our expectation is that disposable income will grow a little bit more rapidly than consumption during 07. So that will restore some liquidity. But it also means that the rate of growth will diminish. We've all been reading a lot about this, and this is a very important consideration, clearly, for investors. This graph depicts the share of national income for employee compensation and economic profits. Profits have done extraordinarily well, and it is, I think many expect that that hasn't gone unnoticed in Washington. So we would not be surprised to see some change in tax policies that affect profits. Corporate profits with inventory adjustment in 06 were up in the high teens, or almost 20%. Okay, going to page 14, capacity utilization. The economists used to say that if you were at 80% capacity utilization, that meant that you needed new capacity. And we have finally gotten to that level of capacity utilization, and that's helped support an increase in business investment. Capital spending on business equipment has really increased. Note these are dollars, not a rate of change. And if you move ahead to page 16, you can see real GDP, the blue line. You read that on the left scale. Equipment and software expenditures and buildings, that reflects, these are non-residential. You read those percentage change numbers on the right scale, and you can see that they have picked up significantly over the last 2 years in particular. Page 17 shows simply the difference between 10-year Treasury yields and the federal funds rate. And it's difficult to recall, but it just was a few years ago, federal funds were at the 1% level in 03 and early 04. They're now 5.25. 10-year Treasury rates have increased, but nowhere near as much. So we now actually have an inverted yield curve. Short rates are higher than longer rates. Many have said that that really discourages investment. It certainly has been a predictor of every recession, but it's also been a predictor of recessions when there were no recessions. And the amount of inversion here is very modest, but it's something to be mindful of. Federal budget deficit has been, it's still substantial, and if you go out 10 or 15 years past this and the projections when the aging baby boomers figure more prominently, it gets bigger, but federal revenue has been greater than anticipated, and so the deficit has been less than has been anticipated. The current account deficit has been huge, but it seems to be peaking as a percent of GDP. Largely because export growth has been strong. Inflation risk, in our view, remains modest. I won't go through all these points, but we've seen really strong productivity growth. We still see a lot of capacity in global economies. That acts as a deflationary force. This is a comparatively short-term picture of inflation, the rates of change. The CPI, all urban consumers, it's the blue line. The maroon line is the core CPI. We tend to focus on the core CPI. And you can see that that was less than 2.6% last year. Putting it in a longer-term context, it's hard to believe that in the early 80s, the late 70s and the early 80s, we were thinking about inflation rates of in excess of 12%. And they certainly have come down. So while there's been a great deal of volatility, particularly on a month-to-month basis, and particularly when you look at the series that includes energy and food, a lot of volatility. The rate has stayed at comparatively low levels. Okay, we're coming to the conclusion that this page is really an interesting page. We look at the last 7 years, calendar years, and you can see that 2000, 2001, 2002, those were the 3 years of the bear market. And we have the broad U.S. stock market, large cap stocks, small cap stocks, international stocks, and then investment grade bonds and cash returns, and the CPI. Okay, and then we show 5-year, 10-year, and 15-year compound annual returns. I'd call your attention to the 10-year number. Those 10-year numbers include the worst bear market since 73, 74, and arguably since the 1930s. And they also include a very strong recovery subsequent to that bear market. The broad U.S. stock market over that 10 years returned 8.6%. I call that, and the bond market, if you go down to the Lehman aggregate line, you'll see 624. I think that those are very useful numbers to bear in mind when you think about our capital market projections, which are, I'm going to skip ahead to them. If you go ahead to page 30, you'll see our projections, and we included the projections, the 5-year projections that we presented to you last year. See that all the equity numbers are essentially unchanged from last year. The bond number was increased from 5% to 5.25%. And that really just reflects the change that's occurred in interest rates. The real estate number remains unchanged. Now I'm going back. Here is a graph of the yield to worst on the Lehman aggregate index, which is a good measure of the investment grade bond market. And you can see it ended 06 with a yield to worst at 534. As I've told you in the past, this is our basic building block when we start making projections. Because we found, and this is depicted on page 27, that just naively saying, well, if the bond market today yields 534, that's probably a pretty good projection of what bonds are going to return over the next 5 years. We tested that on the graph that's depicted on page 27, where the blue line reflects the actual 5-year return for bonds, and the red line takes that yield to worst and just pushes it ahead 5 years. And it's not perfect, but it's a pretty good predictor of bond market returns. What about stocks? On page 28, as you've already seen, we left our five-year projection for nominal stock returns unchanged. And a big part of that is that stocks do not appear to be excessively valued. This graph depicts the price-earnings ratio for the S&P 500, and the red line represents the long-term average. So it's very close to the long-term average. If you expected a big earnings decline, then stocks wouldn't be undervalued. And we're not suggesting that they're undervalued. We're suggesting that they're reasonably priced, fairly valued. Another way of looking at stock valuation is to compare stocks to bonds. And when Greenspan was the chairman of the Fed, he had a model that received quite a bit of press, which contrasted the earnings yield on the stock market with the 10-year treasury. And that's what we've done here. The earnings yield is the reciprocal of the price-earnings ratio. So if there's a price-earnings ratio of 20, the earnings yield is 5. A price-earnings ratio of 50, the earnings yield would be 2, and so on. And this illustrates that over the last 2-plus decades, stocks' earnings yield relative to the 10-year treasury looks pretty attractive today. Now, that gap could, of course, be closed with interest rates moving up. It could be closed with earnings declining. Doesn't necessarily mean that stock prices have to advance, but when you look at stocks, you have to say that on a relative basis, compared to in high-quality bonds, they do not look expensive. What does all this mean? If you go ahead to page 31, we input our assumptions into an optimizer to develop so-called efficient portfolios. We've included the permanent funds, existing policy as a point of reference. So using our new capital market assumptions and the old policy, the current policy for the permanent fund, we would expect a return of 7.84%, and that contrasts with 7.77 was the number that we developed using last year's projections, so a tad better. And graphically, this is the so-called efficient frontier. And so the policy is essentially right on the efficient frontier. And that concludes the presentation, Mr. Chairman. I'd really be delighted to take questions. And
I would like to have you turn back on to slide number 31. And could you, one of the discussions we've had here, there's a high correlation between the permanent fund and the retiree trust as far as portfolios and long-term returns and targets and so on and so forth. Could you explain the matrix here in a little more detail? I see there's the one column, third one from the right, that shows your allocation for 06 with a target of 7.84%. If we were to push that target up on your expected return to 9 or 10, how would that be done, and what risk would we bear on the not only the permanent fund, or if we did a similar exercise and it's more applicable to the retiree accounts? What risk would we be faced with?
Yeah, first let me be sure that everybody understands this table, and then I'll get to the question. What we said to the computer was we want the lowest risk portfolios between 6.5% and 8.5%. And we want to look at basically 5 so that there are meaningful differences. That's what, and then we added in the permanent fund. And so large cap refers to large cap U.S. equities, small to mid cap refers to small to mid cap domestic equities, international equities, emerging market equities, domestic fixed, non-U.S. fixed income, real estate, absolute return, private equity, and cash. Those are the asset categories that were considered. We constrained absolute return to 4%. We said you can't have more than, you can't use more than 4% in absolute return. That's hedge funds, fund of funds, and private equity. And the reason that those were constrained is it's very difficult for a fund of this size to get a lot invested. The permanent fund has been moving to get invested in private equity for several years, but is and has a plan, has made commitments, but the money actually hasn't been drawn down. So those were practical limitations. Now, if we go back to the preceding page, and you just scan down this list of projected returns, you can see that the highest projected return is 12% for private equity. So theoretically, one could have a portfolio of 100% private equity and hope to earn 12%. It would clearly be imprudent. Nobody's suggesting that. But what that does, it helps illustrate that now if you look at Mix 5, which would have an expected return of 8.5%, see the column standard deviation across the table? The further you move to the right, the greater the proportion of the portfolio that's committed to equities or equity-like investments. And so for Mix 5, find domestic fixed income, it's only 12%, nothing in international fixed income. So it's basically 88% in equity-linked investments. I mean, real estate equity is equity. Absolute return is hopefully more bond-like in volatility, but taking aggressive positions. And the rest of the portfolio is would largely be in publicly traded equity, domestic and international, large and small. So pragmatically, I guess where I'm going, Mr. Chairman, is to say I think you can get up and plans such as the retirement board have targets at near the 8% level in today's environment if you agree that inflation is going to be 2.75 or that order of magnitude. It's tough to get much higher than a 5.25% real return. And a big part of that is, of course, look at TIPS. TIPS today have
define that, please.
Treasury inflation protected securities. So no credit risk, obviously. There's nothing higher quality. Treasury obligation, but they have an implicit real return of just a little bit over 2%. So if in the real return from in the highest investment grade bonds is somewhere south of 3%. So the more of your portfolio that you have in investment grade bonds, the more difficult it is to achieve a real return on the total portfolio in excess of 5%.
So then what, just to recap what you're saying, to take your target of 7.8 or if your target was 8% or 8.25%, anywhere in that range, and you start shoving that up towards 10 and 12 for some reason that you feel you need to have a high rate of return, the volatility, which is reflected in your standard deviation, is going to go substantially higher, and you have a potential of blowing up your portfolio.
Exactly. And just to be sure the people watching on gavel to gavel or whatever understand that concept, standard deviation, the 8%, and let's use mix 4 as an illustration, the middle of a distribution of possible outcomes is 8% with that policy. A standard deviation of 12.1 says that in a year, that policy might produce between 20, plus 20%, plus 20.1%, or a negative return of 4.1%. That's one standard deviation. Two standard deviations in a one-year period double that number. And that's the range. So huge increase in volatility. Now, to put it in context, the bear market that we were in was more than a two standard deviation event. So those things do happen. They don't happen, fortunately, frequently, but they do happen. So an investor who has a super aggressive strategy that is almost 100% equity is taking on the volatility. If they can stay the course and don't need the money, they may be much better off in the long run, but they have to live through the shorter run.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to correlate your presentation with Mr. Burns' presentation. His presentation in 2006, the fund returned 11%, well ahead of the benchmark of 10.5%. It's not the same.
That's the
your expected return in your presentation?
Yes.
And well, when I first came to the legislature, the permanent fund was about $8 billion. And in looking at Mr. Burns' presentation in the beginning of 2006, the fund had reached $31 million, so it was around $30 billion. And with his presentation, we can anticipate in the very near future that we're going to see $40 billion. And the benchmark of 7.8 or 8%, it's going to be not too long that we're going to see $50 billion. And from there, you know, if we've increased the fund from $8 billion when I first came here to multiply times 5 to $40 billion, if I double my term and things were the same, we would be seeing a permanent fund in excess of $200 billion.
Magic of compounding, isn't it great?
The question, I guess, that I have is, has the board contemplated how large of the fund should grow, and will we ever change our philosophy on inflation proofing? Because at some point, the inflation proofing is going to continue to take larger and larger chunks of the fund, because and then the legislature has to decide at what point will the legislature start utilizing a portion of the earnings for purposes other than or including the dividend program.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, Let me take the piece that you talked, I think the question about just the growth, and have we thought about changes to what we're going to do as we grow kind of through this next phase? And we spent some time on that actually this summer. We had a board retreat, I think, in August, but staff and Mr. O'Leary's staff spent some time. He has, and I think it's important that he has a range of clients that cover a broad range of sizes of funds. And so we look to him as, are we reaching a point in our growth where we're going to have to think substantially differently about how we do things, why we do things? Is size just in and of itself going to change things? And I think the conclusion we came up with was probably up through the 60 or maybe even 70 number, we really don't change how we think about ourselves. There's a point out there where you start doing things and you have different constraints. Let me give you an example. The huge plans in the country, CalPERS, in private equity, for them to take a meaningful piece of a private company gets to be such a large number that they have things that they have to register with the SEC as an insider and as an investor, over a certain threshold. We're a long way from those types of constraints. So how we're doing things for the time frame between here and $60 or $70 billion is going to be about the same. There'll be a point in our growth when we really, you're a different type of fund, but we're a ways away from that. Did that answer?
Yeah, if I could, Mike, took
a ways away from that at 8%. I don't believe that we're too far away from $70 billion. If it took less than 13 months to get to add $10 billion to the fund.
Yeah, that
at 8.5%.
That's where I'd like to come. And number one, I want to underscore everybody's attitude. We all recognize that this body determines what happens with the earnings of the fund. There's no question with regard to that. The rates of return enjoyed over the last 3 years, 4 years of market recovery have been well above the long-term average. I put up page 24 here because I wanted to draw your attention to the 15-year return for bonds, investment-grade bonds, 6.5% per year. That was a significant part of the return enjoyed by the permanent fund. Because interest rates are so much lower today, we have great confidence in saying we're not going to see 6.5% from bonds. We think 5.25% is optimistic. The same can be said for almost every major asset category. You're all aware of how well real estate has done as an asset class. Our expectation for real estate going forward is 7.6%. For stocks, it's only 9%. So as we look ahead, we are not extrapolating the returns of the last 15 years, nor are we extrapolating the returns of the bounce back from this horrendous bear market that we saw from 2000 to 2002. Does that help?
Let me add one other thing. I think maybe I may have confused you. When I said we were ahead of our benchmark, which was 10.5%, that is not the 7.8% that goes into the asset allocation. Once we decide that that's the proper asset allocation, then we go to the benchmarks that are driven by this, actually right on this slide here. If we're going to have 12, 12% that's going to be tied to the Russell 3000. Do we do better than that? That becomes the benchmark. So how does our performance compare with the cumulative benchmarks that are driven by the asset allocation? Maybe got way inside baseball on that, but there are different levels of.
Yeah, and the 784 is using the asset class projections. It is the target index going forward, based on these estimates.
But a benchmark is how we performed against the rest of the world this year.
Thank you. Let me just add, the balance is roughly $26.5 billion in 2000. So I think one of the points we work with here, if we're at roughly $26.5 billion in the year 2000, now we're rounded off $37 billion. At some point, there's got to be a policy discussion within the state as we fuel this economic engine. How are we going to deal with inflation proofing, and how are we going to deal with any structural changes from a strategy standpoint at this table dealing with our budgets? We're going to be over about $1 billion in 2015 just inflation proof. So we're, you know, that discussion, I guess, is coming attractions. I think that's some of the points that Senator Hoffman was bringing up. This economic engine we have called the Permanent Fund is most likely the fastest growing economic entity we have in the state. This is a huge, huge driver.
Senator, I just to follow on with that, we clearly understand our task is to give you as many options to make those choices that you just delineated there. That's clearly, we want to be as successful as possible, so you'll have as many choices as possible to make those decisions.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Chairman Stedman. Either Mr. O'Leary or Mike Burns, what are your benchmarks? What do you use as a comparison? These are referenced on?
For domestic equity, we use indexes, the S&P 500 and the Russell family of indexes. For investment-grade bonds, we use the Lehman Aggregate Bond Index. For real estate, we use the NCREIF Index, which is a measure of institutional-grade direct private real estate. To the extent that there are REITs, we use an appropriate REIT index. We use public equity markets as a proxy for private equity, and for absolute return, we use a specific target rate, LIBOR, London Interbank Rate, plus 4% as the benchmark for the absolute return managers. I think I got them. And for high yield, we use a high yield bond index.
Did you get the Lehman Ag?
Yeah.
And just so when you reference on this handout that you beat your benchmark by 0.5%, do you have a chart in here that indicates where that difference came from? How well you were doing in a particular asset class?
Not in this presentation. Okay. We don't, but certainly the fund has that information. It's provided to them quarterly. And can be provided to you.
And we track it in a different manner on a daily basis.
Right.
Could you forward possibly the last quarterly presentation to the Permanent Fund Board on the performance breakdown so the members
sure.
who would like could go through it and take a look at that?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Could we, Mr. Burns, could we go back to the earlier comments at the beginning of the presentation? I just don't want the people at home to think that the dividend is such a confusing calculation you have to be the Wizard of Oz to figure it out. And could you go over how the dividend is calculated, not how you would like the process changed to calculate it, but how it's calculated and the impact of dropping off those bear market years for the people of the state?
You get the. Let me start, just Mr. Chair. The basic number is all driven by realized income, And I take you back just a moment. When the fund was first created...
Do you define realized income?
I will.
At home, okay.
And it made a lot of sense at that time because the fund at creation was only a bond portfolio. You realize income from a bond portfolio for accounting purposes in two ways. You collect your interest or you sell the bond at a profit. Those both are classic accounting realized income. For a broader portfolio such as ours, realized income is rents that we receive, it's dividends, it's interest, capital gains when we receive them. What it does not include is unrealized gains, and that would be a piece of real estate we buy for $75 million and it becomes worth $90. There's no realized income in that. We do recognize it for performance, but we don't for the dividend formula. So there is a five-year trailing average, there's a five-year history of realized income. Basically half of that goes into the dividend formula each year. And why it's changing so dramatically right now, as we talked about the bear markets that were falling off, the number that falls out of the formula, the what will become the sixth year, was $257 million. In the first half of this year, our realized income was $1.9 billion. What that will be the next 6 months, it's hard to say, but the number will be dramatically different than $257 million. And next year, the number that falls out of the formula is $355 million. And I think without any capital gains being realized, we have probably a 60, I can't tell you the run rate, but just from dividends, interest, and rents, we have a run rate substantially higher than that. And every time you make a change in the portfolio, you're selling something to put something in another place, and what you sell realizes income. And actually just paying the dividend itself, when we have to come up with $700 or $800 million to pay the dividend, we're selling things that hopefully creates profit. So the realized income is generated in that way. And I would add that we do not manage the fund with an eye towards realized income. We track it, we keep track of it, but we don't make investment decisions based on realizing income. We make investment decisions based on what is best for the fund's total return.
Thank you. So the people at stake can conclude that unless the financial markets turn really, really sour, that we'll see substantial increases in the dividend across the state the next couple of years.
I think that's a very fair statement.
And then just to get a little bit of laundry on the table, you know, we talked about tens of billions and all this other high finance stuff, but let's talk a little bit about the 50 cents and the impact on the dividend that some other people are curious about, the accounting glitch, that entry glitch that...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the 50
cent? 50 cent impact because of the loss of data?
We have to...
Go ahead.
We have to compute the effect of, I believe it was the difference between the 25...
There was a data entry error. There's a loss of data in the calculation of the entry of the recipients of the dividend, which created a re-entry of data.
You know, we don't do the dividend distribution itself, so I think unless I don't understand your question, I think that's probably the Department of Revenue,
right,
dividend division.
Right, we'll bring them in and have them explain that.
I either think they're the appropriate ones, or I just don't know the answer. I don't.
Either way, it's not that big of an issue. It's an issue out there. It's just nice to have it all on the table. Senator Huggins.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I look at the last category in the left-hand column, it says inflation. And I'm going to ask a question for one of my constituents, and I'm sure that you've heard from him multiple times. It's about deflation,
right.
Tuesday events. And you know, the risk factor there. His theorem is that we manage the inflation, but deflation may be our greatest nightmare. And I, as I recall, Mr. Greenspan sort of, in a predictability, I think it was on Monday, talked about recession. But could you, in 30 seconds burst or less, give us your thought about the difficulties of deflation and as it pertains to the Herman Fund?
By definition, deflation is destructive of wealth. It is exceedingly bad for financial markets. I generalize by saying there are only two types of investments. You can lend somebody money or you can be an owner. And being an owner in a deflationary environment tends to be bad. Being a lender, if the lender doesn't go bankrupt, is good. So if you really felt that deflation were a significant risk, the best investment strategy would be to own long-term government bonds. And that's part of a diversification strategy. That's one of the roles that bonds fulfill in a diversified portfolio. If you saw signs of that coming, that you might accept a lower real return to try to protect your store of value.
Thank you.
Other questions from the representatives or the senators here? Do you have any closing comments? Or?
I just have some closing comments, just one basically, and I would, on behalf of all Alaskans, I'd like to thank the board for all of their hard work and dedication. I know that it does take time out from their daily lives, and I'm sure all Alaskans appreciate the hard work that the board members do on behalf of them.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Just a quick question. Page 31, do you do that on an annual basis, that asset mix alternatives? Is that what you do on an annual basis, or is this generally, or is generally as the column listed as AP, the Alaska Permanent Fund 2006, are we generally around 50, 55% stocks and 30 bonds?
We do review this, and the board will be reviewing it later today and at their next meeting, where each year they annually adopt an asset allocation policy. They are mindful of the changes in relative value between stocks and bonds and other asset categories, and are constantly considering ways to try to improve the return and risk characteristics of the policy. So, long-winded answer to a question, it gets changed. You provided, the legislature provided enhanced flexibility to the permanent fund, which has resulted in the addition of asset categories such as absolute return and private equity. Mm-hmm. And so those, in my view, are still in the ramp-up stage. And 5 or 10 years from now, I'd fully expect them to take a larger role in the portfolio. The equity, total equity position has increased over the last 10 years by quite a bit.
Thank you.
One, just to add to that, just real briefly, you will see some of our things looking a little bit differently. A change we have made this year, and it changes how it looks. It hasn't changed yet how it operates. We have had domestic allocation to equities and an international allocation. Underneath that, we have had global managers. But how we accounted for it was we'd take their domestic portion of their global stocks and put it with our domestic, and their international stocks with our international. We have now, just the board meeting before this, made a specific allocation to global. So we will have domestic, international, and global. And it's going to be about the same portfolio as it was, but it'll look different. But we thought the acknowledgement of a global portfolio, and it created some other changes also, but there's some things that look a little bit different. And the difference, international is international, domestic is domestic, global allows the manager to go anyplace.
We're in the process of losing our House members. I think there's a floor activity there on the House side. So Senator Elton has a question, and then we'll go ahead and adjourn after his question.
And this question may have been asked and answered by Senator Hoffman, but if I remember correctly, you said that when the fund gets to 60 or 70 billion, it's going to require a change in management. And at the rate that it is increasing, I mean, the size of the fund is increasing, far outpacing inflation. I mean, it seems to me that we do hit, excuse me, we do hit the level of $60 million relatively soon. I mean, even if we just increase at the rate of inflation, we get there in 12 or 13 years. And so I'm just wondering if you can give us some kind of an idea what you mean by change in management and when you begin planning for that change, because it seems to me that change in management is coming quite quickly.
Let me just where we are today and through that point in time, whether it's 60 or 70 or what that number is, what we have today is the size to be able to access the very best talent in the world. And that's our challenge, is to make sure we're getting the best talent. So we are in that upper tier already, and we will continue to be in that upper tier. I think when you go over that threshold, wherever it is, you still access the best, but you have challenges just because of your size. So it's probably not a change in management as much as a change maybe in thought, and maybe there are restrictions because of your size. I mentioned CalPERS issues. Michael, I don't know if you see that any differently or what.
No, I think that captures it well. The state of Washington has over $58 billion investments in their retirement system, and they make extensive use of what others perceive to be illiquid markets in real estate operating companies and private equity. But they've been doing it for 20 years, and it takes time to build the infrastructure to support that type of investment program and to get it in place. And I think that's the type of change that I would envision is.
We're going to take one more short question from a House member as a courtesy, and then we need to shut down so you guys can do the people's work on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, Mike, on you mentioned that unrealized gains are not reflected. Are there any sideboards on unrealized losses in that regard as we move into, you know, reducing the fixed income and moving over into some of the, you know, the riskier areas?
The unrealized losses are considered to be part of the principal, as under the current Attorney General's opinion. I wish my chief financial officer is not here, but I believe that is the case. But unrealized losses do offset unrealized.
You have Chris back there.
Okay. Is that Chris? Yeah, they are part of the principal.
So that's.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. Meeting adjourned.